different than what he gets there.
I'm interested in the theology of Judaism. Judaism is not just a system of rules and regulations and commandments, very, very intricate, hundreds of thousands, millions of rules governing. I mean, there's 613 commandments, but each mitzvah contains an infinite amount of requirements and rules and all of that. That's not what I'm talking about. What's the theology? What is Judaism? What are the ideas of Judaism? What is it? Is it a religion? And if so, what's the essence of, what distinguishes Judaism from other religions in terms of its ideas? Its ideas about life, its ideas about man, its ideas about the goal of life, its ideas about our relationship. What constitutes the essence of this religion? That's a pretty good question. That's a very challenging. I could have made that the theme of the class just by itself. But I am, in a sense, because it's not a simple answer. It depends who you ask. And that is not, it's not necessarily going to be the case that the lines will be drawn according to the Orthodox conservative reform. Orthodox and conservative thinkers might be more in agreement than some within the Orthodox circles themselves, if you understand what I'm talking about. So for my purposes, I'm pretty much going to stay within the Orthodox world. Those who would regard themselves as Orthodox, basically, in terms of adhering to the oral law, to the obligations of keeping the halacha in every respect, and so on and so forth. And within the framework of what we would call Orthodox Jews, it seems to me that there's thousands of religions. There aren't. I would say I observe certain groups of Jews, and we do the same thing. I mean, comes Rosh Hashanah, we blow shofar. Comes Pesach, people are meticulous about getting rid of the chametz and eating matzah and all of that. But in my own mind, when I see how they view it, how they understand it, and what it means to them, it seems to me that we're not practicing the same religion. I encounter many, many, and I think that they would say the same thing about me. I mean, about there's different. Otherwise, what differentiates them? So why do you have to have so many different sects? First of all, Chassid, and that's one of the topics, versus non-Chassidim. What differentiates them? Well, Chassidim really, really are committed to their system. They really believe that they have the right Judaism. So, okay. If they have the right Judaism, then they have to believe that we don't have the right, whoever's not a Chassid. I have no problem. By the way, that doesn't bother me. That does not bother me. I have no problem with that. There is, in my opinion, there's such a thing. I don't subscribe to this philosophy that's very popular today, that all, as long as you're practicing Judaism or whatever kind, it's all good. I'm not saying it's not all. I don't mean it in that sense. Okay, fine. I get along with all Jews, and I encourage people, whatever you're doing, you know, to try and continue and to try and improve. That's not my point. The question is it true? There is a truth. There is a, what God revealed. I mean, the Judaism is based upon revelation. And God revealed something to us. He revealed, we would call it a religion. That's another one of my questions. Is Judaism a religion altogether? I'll be taking that up. Is it a religion? Or is it a philosophy? We have great philosophers. We have the Rambam over here. How did the Rambam view Judaism? Did he view it as a religion? Or did he view it as an abstract philosophical system? But if that's the case, there's truth. There is a truth. And that's what the Jewish people is striving towards. In my opinion, that's the historical mission of the Jewish people, is to practice Judaism. When I say practice Judaism, I don't mean put on a talis and put on tefillin and eat kosher. If you subscribe, it is possible for a person to subscribe. I'll show you in a second. Or prove it to me. Is it possible for a person to keep, be very, very observant in terms of the mitzvot, and still not be practicing Judaism? There is a group out there that will indicate this answer, that will give you a, is it possible? It certainly is. Tell me the name of the group. Jews for Jesus. I'll give you an example, Torah character. Well, we just saw recently when Ahmadinejad, when he came recently, I was up in Colombia, there was a protest over there against his coming, whatever the case, but there was a group of the Torah Karta that met with him. And they gave him a gift, and they bestowed great honor on him. He should have a sweet year because he's such a sweet, loving person. Because he loves Jews. He takes, he has Jews in Iran. There's about, 14 Jews left in Iran. And he protects their rights. Well, you had the same thing with Arafat. They embraced Arafat. I don't think that he was ever, that Arafat ever repudiated and ever really made peace with Israel. But whatever, even before that time, when he was killing Jewish children. So is that Judaism? Yeah, these people are very meticulous. These people are extremely meticulous in their practice. They're probably more strict in many, many ways, or at least superficially so, than many Orthodox Jews. But would you say that they are practicing Judaism? So there's a complete... Now, and I mentioned Jews for Jesus, because I thought that would be the most obvious example. I think most of you people would agree that they're not. That's not the practice. That's not what Judaism stands for. So a person can have a different kind of a philosophy, a philosophical understanding, and for whatever reason, he could be adhering... He could be adhering to there. I'm sure that there are, and I don't mean to offend anyone, there are people who practice Jews for Jesus that may be more meticulous in halachic observances than many ordinary Jews. But are they practicing Judaism? That's my question. People can be very strict. Well, what about when we read about it in the paper about some case of corruption in business, some scandal, and the individual is someone who's obviously very, very religious, and he has a beard, and never misses it, always goes, that's what they say, he's such a wonderful person, he always goes to synagogue, he always supports causes, this and that, but there's a slight little problem over here, in terms of his practice of business. Questions being raised now, well, what about the opposite? Since I've said that one can be scrupulous in the performance of the mitzvos, and yet, in the abstract philosophical sense, that's not Judaism. He's not practicing Judaism. So the question is being asked, now what about in the reverse? Is it possible that a person should be very, very minimalistic, to put it gently, and not be, maybe not going to shul that often, or whatever the case is? Everybody checks in at certain times of the year, right? There's certain things. Everybody checks in on Hanukkah. Passover is big, the Seder. Surprisingly though, what is the most surprising, but very, very popular, one of the most popular Jewish holidays, very surprisingly so? You never pitch on Yom Kippur. Passover, yes. Passover is not, Passover is nice, it's the Seder, it's the pageantry of all, But Yom Kippur, I find that Jews of all stripes, from all backgrounds, it's very, very important to them. And no matter what they do, they can eat treif all year, or this, that, but when it comes to Yom Kippur, and not only just to go to shul, but want to fast. So for some reason, that does strike a chord. But what about a person that's very minimal as far as that's concerned? Is it possible that such a person who's not observing the mitzvot of Judaism, according to what I'm saying, can that person still be practicing Judaism? That's one of the most challenging questions I've ever received in this forum. In a sense, yes, I have to be very careful about this, because I'm talking philosophically. I've got to be very, very careful when I answer, because I cannot mislead people in any way. So, we're teaching and we're just dealing with ideas, but I'm still a rabbi and I have responsibilities. Yes and no. I'll just give you the side of yes, but that side of yes does not apply to anyone in this room. There are a group of people that, in my opinion, are practicing Judaism properly, much, much better, actually, than many, many Jews, and yet they're not keeping the commandments. These people are called Noahides. A Noahide, and this is a little bit of a digression, a Noahide is a Gentile who has renounced, he doesn't have to renounce other religions, he could be someone who didn't subscribe to a different religion. Many of these people have been led from Christianity, they've traced their way back to discover the real Judaism. And they're not Jews, they did not convert to Judaism, because Judaism does not demand that they convert to Judaism. Judaism does not demand that a Gentile convert to Judaism. The Torah does, however, contain a system of rules that a righteous Gentile must live by. If the person lives according to these rules, that person, we embrace that person, we support that person as a righteous Gentile. You've heard that expression, the righteous Gentile. It didn't originate, by the way, in the Holocaust. There is a section in Yad Vashem for the righteous Gentiles, significant amount of whom actually did risk their lives to save Jews. But the righteous Gentile, according to the Torah, doesn't have to be in that, doesn't have to be one of those people, but he embraces the Torah as God's revelation, and the rules and regulations, the minimal, the seven Noahide laws. He can add to it and do more. I have a group of people that have renounced Christianity, and they study Torah with me. They don't have to keep the mitzvot, though. I'm not going to go any further. They observe Shabbos in a certain way, not halachically. So here are people that are not keeping, they are not keeping the Torah in the sense of keeping the commandments, because the commandments, the 613 commandments, are obligatory upon the Jews. That's our mission as a nation, that we have to uphold the entire Torah and be an example for the entire world. And the Gentile whose heart moves him to do so, he wants to become part of this movement, he wants to become part of this people, he can convert to Judaism, at which point he does become obligated. But he has the option. It was a very interesting experience when I had him down in my shul. And it's an amazing thing, because many, many Jews, and even Orthodox Jews, because we're going to be honest over here, feel that it's a big burden. They keep it, but it's a big burden. That shouldn't be the attitude, because once a person studies it and realizes the beauty of Judaism, he should love to do the mitzvot, but that's an ideal. The reality is many Jews are sort of in a bit of a conflict. It's a big burden, and it conflicts with American life for many people. That's the truth. That's the true feeling. We can be honest. Judaism, by the way, doesn't demand that you be dishonest. You should be honest about your feelings. So many people sort of said, "Whoa, this guy, they have a lot of choice. They have it good. It's a great deal." But when I say they're practicing Judaism, what do I mean they're practicing Judaism? How are they practicing Judaism? They're practicing Noahidism. They're practicing Noah, correct? That's the question you were going to ask me, right? The question of what is Judaism has been debated throughout. This is the essence of the controversies. The great controversies that I've chosen, the so-called wars of the Lord for the sake of heaven. All of the, basically the ones that I've chosen, the Maimonidean approach, the mystical approach, Kabbalah, that you've all, you know, everybody's become the rage today, Kabbalah, or is Hasidus. Each one of these groupings has a different orientation, a different understanding as to what Judaism is. Not, as I said, with regard to the mitzvot necessarily. That always will enter into it one way or another. But in terms of what it is, what's the goals, what's the philosophy, and I'm going to explore them. I just want to answer this question first. What do I mean when I say that these Noahide people who are not keeping the commandments, except for the seven, they have the right, some of them take on more commandments besides the seven, but they don't have to. So in what sense are they adhering to Judaism? So it's not Judaism, it's Noahidism. What I mean to say is that Judaism is a philosophy of life, and it has values that you live by, goals that you seek. And a person who subscribes to that way of life, and in all of its manifestations, if you can extract from the commandments a philosophy of life, and I could give over Judaism as a philosophy of life. If you understood that what the purpose is, for example, of the mitzvah of kosher, that there's a goal behind that, it's a certain philosophy, then it is possible that people can observe the basic goals behind it, even though they don't have this particular system which implements it. So that, and I could prove to you again that this has to be the case, who were the first practitioners of Judaism in history? This is the time. Abraham was studying, these parshios are extremely, extremely important. If you want to know about Judaism, come to my shul in the next few weeks. That's it, just for a few weeks, on Shabbos. Because I'm going to be elucidating the derech, so to speak, the way of the fathers. That's our way. We're supposed to emulate the fathers and the mothers, the matriarchs, and read the stories. What's the philosophy of life? What's the religion that they practice? That's what we're going to be paying attention to. Now, they clearly, I think they're good Jews. I don't think anyone in any movement that's ever grown since that time is going to deny and going to say, well, no, the patriarchs, were the patriarchs Hasidim? Did they hold a tish and they gave out, you know, little pieces of challah? Were they Hasidim? Did they visit graves and throw notes into it and things like that? Many of the things that we do today, I guess each group looks back and they identify to, you know, to some people, that's what Abraham must have looked like a chassid. Or other types of, the answer is, they didn't keep the mitzvahs. They were Noahide. Abraham didn't keep, when were the mitzvahs given? The mitzvahs were given at Sinai, right?
So, did Abraham keep Yom Kippur? Did he keep kosher? What did he serve the guests? You know, got those guests that came. He practiced the compassion, hospitality, but they said, he told to get the finest meat, the kid, and butter. They put butter. It would appear superficially. I know. You see, apologists will read into it that there are those who maintain that Abraham kept all of the commandments. But the Rambam holds clearly that he did not. The plain interpretation is that he did not. And it would seem that it would be impossible. How could he keep, for example, a Passover? Since Passover, right, commemorates the Exodus from Egypt. I mean, there are ways, but they try and work it out allegorically, whatever you want to say. But the simple meaning is that he did not. And he did keep it. God added to the seven. God added to the seven became complete with, we just, that's past week's parsha with Noah when he came off the ark. So, if that's the case, how is it possible that these individuals who are the epitome of the Jewish people, and that's the reason why God chose us? That's what we say. That's an important point that's made in the Varim. Why did God choose us? Because we're superior? Because we're better? Why did God choose the Jewish people? God makes it very, very clear. Not because of our superiority, not because of our size. For you are the smallest of all the nations. So why did God choose us? But before all of that could have happened, it's because only in your fathers did God, because we are the descendants, the children of Abraham. Bnei Yisrael means Israel, the son of Israel. Who's Israel? Yaakov. But really it means, and in the prayers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. This is my name forever. God, so we are the descendants. God chose them. We are secondarily. All right, we didn't rebel, since we followed in their pathways, and to the extent that we follow. But it's not because we had any intrinsic merit over any of the other nations. So, but were they Jewish? Were our forefathers Jewish? We're supposed to identify with them. Now, you're going to have this dilemma. Because if they were Jewish, how could it be that they didn't keep the commandments? We're living a completely different religion than they, apparently. They didn't keep the commandments. The answer is that Judaism is a way of life. Above and beyond the commandments, it is possible for someone to, at least the way I understand Judaism, not necessarily the way others understand Judaism. I'm giving you my personal, I'll show you where it comes from. The way I understand Judaism, it is possible for an individual to live according to the Jewish way of life, even though he may not be observing the Jewish religion. There is a Jewish religion, though. This is possible, however. It's obviously possible in the case of Abraham and the fathers, because it didn't exist at that time. It was coming into being. They discovered the correct way to serve God. That's the essence of Judaism, is the correct way to serve God. This is what God approves of. There are many, many religions in the world. Judaism rejects religion in the ordinary sense. That's another thing that you need to know. I'll explain the difference between Judaism and religion. Because Abraham, and then he perpetuated it, because they discovered, it's called the Derech Hashem, the true path to God, and they lived according to that path on the highest possible level. We don't reach, very, very rare that anybody would reach that kind of a level. They were prophets, and God communicated to them. And because of that, God determined that their children would be the ones who would have the system. It was systematized. The way of life of Judaism was systematized. In order to be perpetuated, it had to be systematized, because in the days of Abraham and the people, it was an abstract system of ideas, not beliefs, ideas, knowledge. And he would go around and he would teach people and inculcate people. What was he teaching them? To put on a talus? He was teaching them about the true way to understand God. What do I mean when I use the word God? The true way to relate to God, and the true religious experience that God approves of. Not that is meaningful to me. That's another big mistake that people make today. They're searching for that which is meaningful to them. I'm totally opposed to that whole thing. I go where I find inspiration. Judaism is not, there's an inspiration, but the inspiration has to be based upon discovering that truth. That it should be in line with the will of God. That that's the way that God approves of. So the answer to that question is...
Yes or no?
Well, but I've shown you how. I've not just said yes and no. It's easy to say yes and no. When you don't back it up, I've backed it up. And I've showed you how the yes fits in. You've learned something. Where does the no fit in? The no fits in once we have Sinai. Once God constituted us, all this is possible before Sinai, because there was no revelation. So God did not establish at that point in time a system whereby these ideas would be carried over and perpetuated. That's a big guy. How do you carry over a system? That's where the religious aspect comes in. Every other philosophy of life that was popular at a certain point in time, the Greeks had a philosophy of life. Does anybody today live the Greek way of life? You'll find books on a shelf, but there's no Greeks out there because it just dissipated. Didn't have any way to perpetuate itself. But where's the no? Where is the no? The no is for you, guys. That's possible for the pre-Sinai generation. It's possible today, too. If you're born a Gentile. So you had the great good fortune to be born Jewish. And once you're a Jew, these are the demands. You have no choice. That's the reality. Everybody, you know, everybody was at Sinai, so to speak. Once the Jew, what did the greatness you mentioned it before, that the Jews of all the nations, God offered the Torah to the other peoples. And they all had excuses, according to the famous Midrash. Whether it's literal, I don't take it literally, it's conveying ideas. All the other nations had questions. Thou shalt not commit adultery, we'll think it over. Thou shalt not steal, and so on and so forth. But what did the Jews say? Na'aseh v'nishma. Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do, and we will hear. So the Jews, of course, we had gone through these experiences. I'm not saying, I don't believe that the Jews are intrinsically superior to any people. We don't believe in racial superiority. Anybody, well, first of all, we respect the dignity of all people. As I've just shown you, you can't afflict any person. We're having a little discussion before the class. You see, that's not correct. All people. But Noahides today have that option. They can practice the abstract philosophy of Judaism and live according to that and get tremendous reward. Get tremendous reward. It seems to me that this is my personal opinion, that there are many Noahides that I know that are on an extremely high level, much higher level than many Jews. Because even Jews that are religious, because the tragedy, in my opinion, is that there are many Jews that are religious and they practice the ceremonies, the minutiae of the religion, but never tap into the beauty, to the real perfection lies in discovering the ideas and molding your personality in accordance with the abstract. That's what we're in search of. We're in search of that's the point that I want to go through. That's why I say that we should be in search of God. A person, I'm striving to discover the true Judaism. I'm striving to discover it. I'm not arrogant just to say that I have it. The Judaism that I practice, that's the right one. But I am telling you that, you know, at least I'm searching for that. I've been searching for that all my life, and that there's many different Judaisms out there. And the purpose of this is to go through some of the major formulations of what Judaism is and what the controversies were, because this will impact the Judaisms that people are practicing today. They didn't just get started today. They have a history to them, and if you understand that history, if you understand the history and how it came into being, you'll be in a much better position to evaluate it and to make some kind of a determination as to what it is. What's Hasidism? Hasidism is a recent phenomenon. It's only a few hundred years old, Hasidus. So what is it? How did it come into being? What's its unique idea? Our question was, can you be a religious Jew and not believe in God? Well, I don't know what... The essence of Judaism is its unique idea of God and man's relationship to God. And everything flows from that. That this is a system, we use the term service of God.
Don't take it in the wrong way. I'll have to explain what that means. But basically, Moshe, we just learned about the death of Moshe. That Moshe Rabbeinu, how is he referred to? The greatest of the Eved Hashem, the servant of God. He achieved that perfection in terms of the true service of God. So that there's no such thing. There's no such thing as an atheist who's a good Jew. Doesn't make any sense. Now, I know what you're saying. What about wonderful people that are humanitarian and do good deeds? And that's not Judaism. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm not putting it down. But let's be honest. It's not Judaism. Judaism, compassion, the way of Abraham entailed compassion. Compassion was a fundamental, but it's a specific kind of compassion that involves helping people physically and taking care of their physical needs, but that's just the beginning. The ultimate compassion for mankind is leading man to his true purpose. And his true purpose has to do with a certain acknowledgement, recognition, and relationship to the Creator. Therein lies the perfection of the soul. That's a fundamental. That's a fundamental. In my opinion, if you deny that, you're denying Judaism. You can still be a good person. I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm not saying that. I have nothing against atheists. But the honest answer to the question, but you're not a good Jew. And if that's important to you, if you want to be Jewish, that's where it started, that Abraham discovered God. Abraham discovered God. That's what we're going to be doing. The question arises, how is it possible that you could have so many divergencies? For example, among the Orthodox, pretty much there's general agreement, pretty much, in terms of the halachic observance. All the groupings that fall within the Orthodox basically have a similar approach to the keeping of halacha, keeping of the mitzvot. It's going to be pretty much the same. If that's, there's a reason for that. So why is it that there's so much divergency in this other area, in the area of the theology of Judaism? You have to understand something as we proceed. When we talk about halacha, there is what we call the masorah. The masorah means the oral tradition. It was very, very specific that the rules and regulations, the oral law, if you're Orthodox, it goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe received it from God, that he received the written law. And then, of course, all of the whole series, the whole system of interpreting the mitzvos was transmitted orally from generation to generation to generation. And eventually there came a point in time when it started to be written down. But there it's very, very specific. The laws are very, very specific, so that there was never a time when there was a different version of what tefillin are and what correct shechita is, etc. All of these laws, the slaughtering of the animal, all of these laws were exact. So you didn't have an evolution when it comes to halacha. There's no evolution going on. I mean, there's expansion, there's development, because the rabbis have the right, basically, to enact decrees as the situation demands. But it's pretty fixed. It's pretty fixed, so that an Orthodox Jew, whether he's modern Orthodox, or whether he's more to the right wing, or whether he's Hasidic, whatever it is, they can all pretty much, when it comes to ritual observance, I can go to any shul and take a lulav, and it's kosher lulav, whatever. And things like that, because we're all following pretty much the same halacha, because that wasn't given over to evolution, if you're Orthodox. But when it comes to the theology of Judaism, it's different. This is very important, because people want to know, how is it possible, if it's from Sinai and it's from God, that everybody has his own opinion? In halacha, it's not the same way. But how is it possible then? So just so we should all know what exactly Judaism is. Why am I asking this question? Why am I involved in a search? And why am I saying that the Jews are searching for it? And in my opinion, that's when the Jews discover what Judaism is and they start practicing it, that's Mashiach. Then Mashiach will come. Practicing philosophically the true ideals of Judaism, the reason is because when it came to that, we don't have the same kind of a masorah. What's a good word? It wasn't formulated that way. It wasn't that God told Moshe, this is the philosophy of Judaism, this is the correct meaning of the mitzvah of tefillin, this is why you do that, these are the values.
did not give it over that way. So it was given over, so to speak, in a different kind of way. It was given over, you have narratives in the Torah, study the life of Abraham. You got to use your head, you got to be more creative. There's what we call in the Gemara, there's the halacha, then the agada. Have you ever heard the term agada? Or the midrash? So there was never, it wasn't the same way that there was a authenticate, this is the correct, it was never given over that way. It was left more for people, it's there. It is there. If you study the mitzvot and you try and discover what the reasons are, if you study the stories, but the rabbis had their own opinions, they formulated their own theologies. So there, it is, now, there are certain philosophical principles that everybody agrees on. That's, for example, belief in God. Well, creation. That the world didn't come into being by itself. Creation, a belief in God, reward and punishment.
But would creation mean that God...
So therefore, what I'm saying is that it was not given over in the same way. So therefore, it depends, as I said, other than these basic premises. There are basic premises that you can't contest. I mean, if you offer, like the Rambam formulated the 13 principles. These are foundational principles. But these are foundational principles that just every religion is based upon. Revelation, for example. If you deny revelation, then you're denying Judaism. So you have to affirm certain things. Otherwise, there's no Judaism. Now, aside from that, though, and I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about the basic premises. I'm talking about the ideas behind the system. What's it about? What is it that you achieve when you do these mitzvot? It's a way of life? What kind of way of life? What am I struggling for? What is it that finds favor with God? Who is the righteous person? What's the essence of righteousness? These are the kinds of questions. Those answers are contained within Judaism, but you have to search for them. Because you have to search for them, they were great thinkers, but there was never ever a system of psak. We have a system of when there's a debate in the Gemara about what is the true halacha, so at the end of the day, there's a decision. The decision is according to Rava. The decision is according to this rabbi. When it came to philosophical ideas, interpretations, it wasn't treated that way. There was no body. The Sanhedrin didn't get together and say, well, there's a philosophical argument. What's the right one? What's the wrong one? That was never done. Because of that, you're going to find it's a people. They have a history, and there's many, many thinkers, and people have religious ideas, and different formulations of what Judaism is came into being. I just wanted to explain that to you so you should understand what the background is. Why should it be that way? As far as the topics that we've chosen, that I've chosen rather, it's interesting that when I first chose these topics, I looked at them as being separate, as being independent areas. Rambam, for example, that's a major, major figure in terms of Judaism, and his critics, believe me, he had his critics, he was very controversial. And then I have Kabbalah and its critics, Shabtai Tzvi, and the problem of false messiahs. Then you have Hasidism and Misnagdim. Misnagdim are the opponents. When I first started, I was just looking at them as separate issues, separate areas. As I studied it, I see that they're all intertwined. That there's one thing flows from, that's an amazing thing. If you go back to the controversy with the Rambam, that's the bottom line. That controversy that the Rambam fought with his critics, that whole battle, in one way or another, that battle is still being fought today. It permeates, it didn't just go away, and then another set of players came on the scene, and a new battle, not the case. And that's what I'm going to also show you, it's an amazing thing to me, there's an interconnectedness. We're going to start out with, it starts out with the Rambam, and the Rambam triggered a war, there was a philosophical war, and there was a point in time when they actually... Jews actually were responsible for having his books burned. That's how serious these things were taken. And he himself was even accused of heresy. Can you imagine a thing like that? And that's sort of the anti-Rambam faction, that movement, that sort of in one way or another led to the development of mysticism, which is Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, and that became a big, big factor in Jewish history, which has an effect throughout the ages. That movement itself, in my opinion, as I'll show, gives rise to this whole phenomenon of false messiahs. But the most significant thing of all is if you have no concept, if you don't have an understanding of Kabbalah, I mean, it's basic ideas. We're just going to be familiar with it in general. What does it stand for? How is Kabbalah different from the Rambam's approach, Maimonidean approach, or the rationalistic approach? In my opinion, what I'm going to try and show is that without Kabbalah and the effect that Kabbalah, because in my opinion there was a tremendous triumph Kabbalah had in Jewish history in terms of its acceptance, its spread throughout the Jewish world, you cannot have the phenomenon of Hasidus. You can't even begin to understand what Hasidus is without understanding Kabbalah. So there's basically a continuity over here. Now I want to start, as I said, at least get us started. This was the introduction. I want to start with the Rambam. The Rambam controversy. In order to understand the Rambam is, in my opinion, one of the greatest figures in Jewish history. It's very, very difficult to gain any kind of a sense of what the Rambam was, the impact that he had. It's possible to imagine an individual having an impact upon the existence of Judaism, historically speaking, the future of Judaism. I was just thinking to give an example. Each one of you, I'm sure, has some people in the past that have significance to you, great historical figures. So if I were to ask you to think in your own minds, who do you regard as great historical figures? In any, whether it be religious, whether it be Jewish, whether it be in, history or even an American. It seems to me that no matter who the person is, how significant is that person to you? It's interesting. It's an interesting experience. Just that idea, how significant is any individual? A couple of years ago, my wife and I were at a cemetery for a funeral, and you just stop by and you see all these gravestones, people have gone, and that's it. Like, who knows about these people? Well, who cares? I don't mean in a bad way. Who knows? What impact does a person have after they're gone? It's an amazing thing, because when a person is alive, they really think how important and their lives are so important, and that they have certain sense that they'll be remembered and they'll be part of the. The truth is, it's very, very rare. Most people, maybe the family, immediate family, and even then the grandchildren, a little bit, and even so, how much will they remember, or how much of a difference will it make after all is said and done? That's the way it is. But there are some people that really count, so to speak, in terms of history. And think of the people that you would say really count. This person is very, very important, a historical figure. The Rambam is important. I'll just give you from my own personal. I view the Rambam like a Rebbe, like he's my Rebbe. Even though obviously he's dead for about over 1,000 years. That is to say, his works. In my opinion, he took the Torah and transformed it into Judaism. His accomplishments in the realm of halacha, in Torah, in the realm of Jewish philosophy, it's not just me. It's not just me. Even though there was a tremendous controversy, at the end of the day, the entire Jewish world looks up to the Rambam. His works are studied. His works are studied, and it's not just that. The impact it has on my life and my colleagues, when we talk, we get together, if we discuss a subject casually, as though he's in the room. Yeah, but the Rambam says this, and it's not just in Torah. In psychology, in philosophy, even in medicine, in any area, he's part of the ongoing discussion. If somebody comes up and says, oh, you know what the Rambam said about something like that? Oh, that becomes like, all right, so everybody stops in his tracks. That becomes authoritative. So it's very, very rare. I doubt that there's anybody else. If you look up to FDR, to Ben-Gurion, whoever it is who's important to you, I don't think it has that kind of significance in your life. Now, to understand the achievements of the Rambam, you have to have a certain sense of the situation that existed in his time. As I told you before, the oral law, the Torah, the interpretation of the mitzvos, originally was not supposed to be committed to writing. It existed in the form, it's called the oral law. And it wasn't written down. So that there was a reason for that. There's a very good reason for that. There was a group of scholars that dedicated their entire lives to mastering it, to memorizing it, to mastering it, and they were the ones, that's the point. They didn't want any person to just have access to it, so that then it could be distorted, and a person can claim to be an expert because he read a book here, he read a book there. So that was the ideal situation. Eventually, however, it was not tenable. Because this system, while it persisted for many years, it depended upon certain factors. It depended upon the Jews living in their own land and having a certain system of stability. So that the great scholars, you can imagine what this took, the great scholars could come together and undisturbed. The society could foster that type of mastery in which the Torah could be. But what happened was with the dispersions, when the Jews were dispersed and the Jews were subjected to persecutions and so on and so forth, there was a danger that the system could no longer be retained that way. So slowly but surely, the rabbis got together and decided, based upon a verse in the Eis Lasos, Heferu Torah Secha, it's a time to do, they've destroyed your Torah. That is to say that the entire purpose of having it this way, orally, was to preserve the Torah, but if that factor created a danger that the whole Torah could be lost, then obviously they had to make a change. They had to make an adjustment. So it began to be written down. Does anybody know the first formulation of the written? What's it called? What's it known as? The Mishnah. It began, and as you see, if you're familiar with any of this, that when they started to write it down, it was very minimal. They just wrote down basic headings, basic laws. And that wasn't enough. And then the Gemara means the Talmud, the analyses. All the discussions that they had, the analyses going up and back, is the Gemara. So when does the Rambam come into the picture? The Gemara, which is the Talmud, which consists of the Mishnah and the Talmud, which is the analysis of the Mishnah, was completed in 400s, about the 5th century or so. So the Rambam is born in 1135. The period between the completion of the Talmud and the era of the Rambam, that was referred to as the position of the Gaonim. The Gaonim were the great Babylonian leaders, Jewish leaders. And that was the first generation of Jewish leaders after the completion of the Talmud. So they wrote commentaries. Essentially, questions were responsive. Questions were addressed to them, and so forth. Now, when the Rambam, in order to understand what the Rambam achieved, if you want to study something today, even if you have very little background, you want to study about getting ready for Passover. So where are you going to study about getting, or you want to study about preparing for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, or for Sukkot, how to build the Sukkot, or what the laws, so what do? You don't have to study the Talmud. I don't advise you to study the Talmud, because the Talmud is very complicated. First of all, it's in Aramaic, and you don't know the language, and even if you knew the language, you have to go through all these discussions and debates, analyses, and even if you could do all of that, it wouldn't be clear. First of all, it's not even found in one place. Discussions about the same subject can be found in different tractates. So you have to go from this tractate, then it's discussed elsewhere, and then you got to be a genius. That's true. You got to be a genius. Whoever can study the Talmud, and to the extent where he doesn't need anything else, he can figure it out and he can give you over. He didn't study anything but the Talmud. And he'll just one area. I don't mean the whole Talmud. That's an impossibility. That's superhuman. Isn't that superhuman? If anyone studied one tractate of the Talmud and knows it well, he's a genius. But, so what do you do? So today it's not a problem you go to the Shulchan Aruch. Even the Shulchan Aruch, you know, most people will not go to the Shulchan Aruch. That's already too complicated. So there's a how-to book. There's always these, today you have all these how-to books, right? You can go to any Judaic bookstore, virtually every subject in the world, in English too. Step by step, the mezuzah. What place requires a mezuzah? How many feet does it have to be? Etc., etc. Well, you can learn about a sukkah, and there's diagrams too. So today we have all these how-to books, right? All right, that makes life easier. That makes you sort of become an educated. You know, you can gain a certain amount about that. You can't rely on that for everything because there's always a particular. It never fits. You go to any text that you have, it never fits the particularities of your situation. It's almost like it, but not exactly. So then you have what's called a shaila. Shaila means you ask the rabbi. Okay. In the days of the Rambam, that wasn't possible because you didn't have any books like that. You didn't have the Shulchan Aruch. So how did you, if you wanted to study the law? So you have to read the Gemara. I'm telling you, to be able to study Gemara and figure it out, just on a simple level, but to the extent of the expertise that you can actually know what the laws are from the Talmud, that's very, very, that's what we call Gedolim, the great ones. These are geniuses. So the Rambam was faced with this dilemma. The Rambam was an individual who had a sense of the future. I'll quote to you as we go on. He had a sense of the future of Judaism. He was on that level. It's very, very difficult. I know I'm extolling the Rambam with every word. It's hard for me to believe that he's a human being. I'm serious about that. And I'm not a mystical person at all. But if you read his works, if you can appreciate his works, if someone were to tell me that there's different species of humans, that we're a lower, that's a higher species, I would have no problem. And the Rambam is one of them, I would have no problem believing that. It's very difficult to imagine a mind like that. You can only, I can tell you that, it doesn't mean anything if you don't study. If you study some of his works, you may get a sense of that. How a man was a genius in every area, he mastered every branch of knowledge, and whatever he took, he became the leader. He studied medicine late in life because his brother, who did the family business, perished on a sea voyage, and he had to support everybody, so he became a doctor. He became the leading doctor in the world. He's self-taught. And he just, I saw to this day, on the radio, Maimonides Center is doing this thing on the radio. This is Maimonides. The world knows about Maimonides. So, he had a sense of responsibility to the future, and you have to be able to appreciate his courage. The kinds of moves that he made, for us, you know, looking back, you know, we don't see the big deal, so to speak, but you have to know what it's like. He went up, he made big, big decisions. What was the decision? The decision was to write a code of Jewish law. It was never codified before. That means that he will organize the entire body of the oral law. And he gives reasons for it. He gives basically two reasons why he's doing it. He said his concern, because the Jews, in that time, he himself was expelled from Spain when he was 13 years old. A fanatic group of Muslims took over Cordova, and he and his family were expelled. And they were, for many, many years, they were like persecuted and going from place to place. And in that time, he mastered the entire Talmud. He wrote the commentary on the Mishnah. It's hard to imagine how such a thing is possible. But because of these dispersions, it's going to be impossible. Jews are not going to be able to practice Judaism. They're not going to be able to because they will not have a text. In the Talmud they have, but it's a closed book, except for a few. So there's a need to begin a whole new phase in Jewish history, the compendium to write a code. This is the first code of Jewish law. And it's the genius work. I mean, what can I tell you? Broke it up, the organization. That means, because it's scattered throughout, and to put it all together and then organize it. Take every area, laws pertaining to tefillin, and it's organized. Step one, step two, step three. It's an unbelievable phenomenon. But this is a big decision. Who gave you the right to do that? Who appointed you? Many, many rabbis were very discontent. There was mixed reaction in the world because that's not the way Judaism is done. By the way, he didn't. If you study the Gemara, if you study the Talmud, Rabbi Huna says so and so, and the other rabbi disagrees. You're getting the whole debate. You're getting the whole discussion. So you see both sides. So you can see reasons for this, reasons for that. Who am I? I come along. I don't tell you what the. This is it. He decides what the law ought to be. That's what he did. And he did not include his sources either. He didn't include the sources. He didn't include the, he did not include the disputants, that there was a dispute, and this is why he didn't explain that. It was very, and in that sense, it was kind of like absolute. This is it. Simple. It's very, very simple. He determined what, he's the one who determines what the halacha is. That's an amazingly bold thing in a context where we've never had a book like that. He decided on the basis of his own introspection and thought that such a thing was necessary. But you can understand that it in his time, it created a tremendous amount of controversy as to many, many questions that, first of all, and his reasoning. He didn't include it. Very rarely does he include his reasoning. So that's the one area, one of the areas in which the Rambam was controversial. I'm mentioning this to you because if you want to know about the Rambam, you need to know that he was a towering figure. He was a towering figure in the world of both of these areas of Judaism, in the area of the Talmudic, in the area of Jewish law, as well as in the area of the philosophical. Okay, I think we have to pause here. Next week we'll take up the philosophy of the Rambam and what the controversy was about that.